Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 90, Cthulhu. Today, we're joined by Joel Sparks, the designer of Harvest Hoppers and, of course, The Spotlight. Thanks for being on the show and bringing cats to Game Design Unboxed.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
For sure. Now, I'm excited to talk RPG, especially when it's cat-based, because I'm not a huge RPGer normally, but this did sound perfect for someone like me.
That's good to hear. Well, how many cats do you have?
I have three cats, Nova, Sansa, and Banshee, all little nerdy names. What about you?
There's four in my house right now. That's a lot.
Was it just you?
No, my kid brought two extras to me. It was very nice.
Okay, well, see, then it's like slightly better because I'm a singular person with three cats where you're like...
Oh, 3-1, 2-1?
Yeah. I think it makes it better is what I've been told because we've tried to do the crazy cat lady math. And apparently I'm at cat lady... But not crazy cat lady status.
Yeah, that's right.
If I add two more.
More than two gives you, in the game, we call them cat crazies.
So it's gender neutral. Gotcha. Okay, well, good to know.
It is a thing. I always ask about people's real cats because in Cthulhu, all the players are taking the role of real actual cats. It's not a game where the cats walk on 2 feet and speak English and carry swords or guns or wear clothes or anything like that. It's actual real-world cats, except, of course, there's a lot of mysterious stuff beneath the surface that the humans don't know about. But that's the first thing I want people to know is it's not like the Puss in Boots movie. It's actual cats. House cats, show cats, feral cats, purebreds, mixed breed, many different kinds. But there's also... Well, am I jumping too far ahead here?
No, I mean, we can totally jump in. I would say before you start talking about Cthulhu, mind just giving a quick little origin story of how you got into designing games, and then we'll switch over.
Sure. I'm from the before times, from the previous century, and played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons back in the Reagan era. But I've always written my own material, and I got published by Steve Jackson Games in 1999, that was my first paid game publication. And I kind of never stopped. For many years, my brother and I had a company called Faster Monkey Games, and we put out dungeon modules and resource books for the old school Renaissance back in the days when anyone could publish a clone of a D&D system and make their own things for it. That was the license at the time. We had a lot of success with those books. The change was that I wanted something much simpler to play and something that people who weren't necessarily hardcore D&D grognards could enjoy, played in like a one-shot or something like that without having to have a 300-page rule book.
So is that where the inspiration came for Cthulhu?
That is definitely where the mechanical inspiration came from. Turns out there had been prior art kind of similar to my concept of just playing cats. Not what I ended up with, but there were things out there that I didn't know about. But the Cthulhu pun had been done before as well. So I had these mechanics in mind that would simplify everything. And the nice thing about using fuzzy little animals is there's no gear, right? There's no lists of weapons. There's no lists of spells. There's no lists of monsters. There's no monetary system. All of that is eliminated. As I was seeking to make a simplified role-playing game that anybody could get into, those are some of the advantages of going with cats, as well as the fact that I've always been kind of a cat person. So that worked out too.
I was going to say that's definitely got to help. So then for anyone who hasn't played, you started to mention that this is a more simplified version of like an RPG. Does that mean like no math? Like how does the system work? How do you play Cthulhu?
Literally no math. It is in the rules. It is written on the character sheet. Cats don't do math.
I was going to say, can I also become a cat? Because I also hate math.
As far as I'm concerned, yeah. You can at least play one. It's a simple system where everything's 2d6. I have special dice for it called cat dice that show a sad cat on a 1 and a 2 and a happy cat on a 3, 4, 5, 6. The new ones that we're printing this year actually, in addition to that, have like different types of cat faces on them. So the 6 is extra excited and the 1 is extra sad. And you just roll 2 dice and see how many happy cats you got. And as you can tell from the numbers, I'm sorry, this is math, but it'll be quick. As you can tell from the fact that a 3 through 6 is a success, you're more likely to succeed than not. The odds are stacked in favor of the player cats, which is only appropriate, I think.
So since you don't have gear and monsters and stuff, what does succeeding look like? Like, paint a picture.
Okay, well, there's two things that interact. One is challenges that are defined by the cat herder. That's the person who's running the game. And in the DM, basically. And in the published adventures, the challenges are listed for you. But as cat players improvise, new ones will come up all the time. But all the cat herder has to decide is this an easy challenge or a hard challenge? An easy challenge, you just need one success on the 2 dice. So you roll them and you see if at least one happy face came up. If it did, you got it. A hard challenge, you need 2. So you roll and you see if they both come up happy. That's it. The other wrinkle to it, though, is what we call the right cat for the job. And if you can convince the cat herder that your cat is the right cat for this job, whatever that challenge is, you get one free success. So an easy challenge is automatic for you. And a hard challenge, you've got about a 2/3 chance of making it. Sorry, more math.
You're totally good. I don't hate math that much. I wouldn't have a job right now.
Well, that's the way game design should work, I think, is the designer has to do an enormous amount of math, especially for a more complicated game like Harvest Hoppers. But the players shouldn't have to, in my opinion. It should be built into the structure of the game.
Okay, so then what makes a cat the right cat to send on whatever the adventure?
To meet that particular challenge?
Yeah, like who are you starting with?
That's exactly the right question. I mentioned before, cats have different backgrounds. Some of them are just house cats. The default is a mixed breed house cat. Oh, like this little buddy that just walked up to me. Hey, buddy, talking about you. You could also be a show cat, which is rare, or a feral cat, which is common. But each cat has 1 of 5 roles, and the real cats you know in your life are going to fit into one of these 5 roles. It always works. Sometimes a cat will change over the years from one role to another. It's like a character class, except it has no statistical abilities. It's just the main influence on whether you're the right cat for a particular challenge. Like the catcrobat is one of the roles. That's the fastest cat. Even for a cat, it's good at dexterity and jumping and balancing. And catcrobat always goes first in any situation, which helps the GM, the cat herder, because you just start with the catcrobat player when you're asking people what they do and then just go around the table. They always get to act first. So they're the right cat for a challenge, which is like walking on a wire.
Yeah.
Right. Or climbing over a tricky fence or something. Then you've got your scrapper, which is your big tough cat. Good for anything that involves brute force, intimidation, fighting, which is called scrapping in this game. The way cats fight is spelled out in the game too. Basically, you do a lot of spitting and posturing, and then if one of them wins a roll off, the other one backs down. It's very seldom that a cat actually wants to kill another cat or injure them even. It's mostly just getting your way by getting them to back down. And scrapping is, unfortunately, it has become one of the more complicated things in the game, but it's only complicated compared to the other rules. It's incredibly simple compared to other combat games. I'll jump back to that. But for scraps, your scrapper is the right guy, the right cat. The pussyfoot is a cat that gets by on charm, can always get a human to feed it or pick it up and cuddle it, or sometimes follow. It's hard sometimes to get humans to follow the cats where they think the humans need to go, but the pussyfoot's the right cat for persuading them. Can sometimes even persuade like a big dog or something to back down. That's the charmer. Then you have your tiger dreamer, which is a cat that sleeps even more than other cats. But, and what makes this Cthulhu and not just a cat game, is that there is chaos in the world. There are the chaos gods of the other animals with their plots against human civilization, which was invented by cats, by the way. And the tiger dreamer, when they sleep, can see into the dream world and sense the movements of magic and the gods and the cults. And sometimes even when awake, can get a sense something's not right here. That bird isn't natural or something like that. So that's your mystic, the tiger dreamer. And finally, the two-footologist, derisively known as the poker. The two-footologist is your curious cat that studies human beings and the way they do things. And if you've ever known a cat that could flush a toilet or open a screen door or that kind of thing, or work the handle on a cabinet, complete two-footologist. So when you have to deal with humans and their ways and their devices, the two-footologist is the right cat for the job. So that's all five of the roles. And with that, and then you add onto it your physical description of the cat. By the way, you have to draw your cat on your character sheet. It's a rule. Doesn't have to be good, but you do have to do it. So with your background and your description of the cat, and especially what role you are, people pick up very quickly what cat is the right cat for a particular challenge. Sometimes you have to send the wrong cat for it. It's just the way the adventure plays out, or cat venture, as we call them. Sometimes the cats are split up, and a catcrobat has to be the one that tries to, figure out how to open a door or something, when you would prefer a two-footologist there to do that. Because it's so simple, it runs well with a high player count. So if there's six or more players, and I've done it with, I think I did 12 once, but it works pretty well at 4, 5, 6, even up to 8. I wouldn't recommend 12 the first time you go cat herding, but you can get used to it because there's a lot of improvisation. I feel like I'm talking too much. Are there a particular question you want to steer?
No, you're doing good. It's funny because I was actually going to ask how many players, but I guess what does a campaign look like? Is this we do this for months? Do we do this as a one shot? Like, what is it geared towards?
It's designed to work as a one shot because a lot of the people who have expressed interest in it and played it over the years really like to be able to do this for one night as a break in their more serious campaign that has lots of rules and stuff. Maybe one player can't make it. It's easy for someone who's read through Cthulhu, and the main book is only 40 pages, half letter size, to say, all right, well, I'm going to run a Cthulhu adventure tonight. Whoever can make it, and then they can be done that night and go on to something else if they want. You can do campaigns. I mean, it's been out for 10 years. So sometimes I've had groups that are following up on a previous adventure. One of the rules for the cat herder is there's always a conspiracy behind everything that goes wrong. I call it Oswald's razor. Even the simplest situation, like you're out of cat treats or something, it's always part of a vast plot. And you're not going to get to the bottom of most chaos plots in one session. But that's fine. You solve the immediate problem. The cats get to be heroic. You move on.
So when you're building out your cat and you've got your little player sheet, what does the player sheet look like for this game?
Well, I'll send it to you.
That's not helpful for the audio, but sure.
It is not. But you can post it if you want. It's fine. In fact, it's a free download in a few different places. You have to name the cat. You have to say which role it is of the five roles. And you physically describe it. And you say whether you are purebred or mixed breed, whether you're house cat, feral, or a show cat. And then in the book for the players, if you math it out, again, sorry, but all the math is done ahead of time, there are 30 possible combinations of those. There's five roles, there are three lifestyles, and there's two types of breeds. So that makes 30 different combinations, and there's a suggested personality and backstory for each of those 30 in the rules. So you could say, oh, I'm a feral mixed breed tiger dreamer. And that then you might look it up and you're a street prophet. You're like an older cat that lives on the street and sees into the mystic, and other feral cats come to you for advice. There's no mechanics in it, certainly no math, no gear, but it suggests who your cat is. And you're free to make up your own backstory, of course, but there's 30 in the book already, so that's a fair amount to choose from. And then that helps you say, oh, well, I'm a, feral street preacher cat, basically. So am I familiar with some of the places in the city where maybe the rat god holds sway? And then the cat herder would say, yeah, there's a sewer that's known cats don't go in there. Off the top of your head, maybe. Or maybe that's built into the cat venture.
So how did you go about playtesting this game and developing it?
Well, it has gone through some iterations. I wrote it in 2013, and fortunately, my crunchy RPG-addicted friends around here were willing to play cats for a little while. So I found some rough spots, and then I took it to a lot of conventions. The first thing I did was print an ash can, which was just like the rules just as they'd come out of my head, and I did have them edited, but it was very, very small, almost pamphlet-like set of basic rules for it. Took that around to a lot of conventions, and then I actually went to Gen Con with a bunch of them and just staffed my own booth, tiniest booth I could get, but completely sold out. People were crazy for it. And then I gathered a lot of feedback. I tried to get people's email addresses or tell them to contact me, and everyone who was willing to talk about it, I took their feedback. And that's when I took it to Kickstarter for what I called the Deluxe Edition. So I rewrote the rules, took feedback, simplified them, playtested those rules, and came out with the Necronomicon, which is the 5x8, 40-page black and white booklet with great cover art. I was lucky to get it. I worked with this artist, Carolyn Jamhor, out of Brazil, and she's great. So the cover art was great. I took it to Kickstarter, and it did super well. I mean, I'm lucky that people are interested in the concept of just saying, well, all you have to do is act like a cat. So I ended up coming out with not only the new version of the basic book, the Necronomicon, but two books after that, The Cat Herder's Guide, which tells a lot more about the chaos gods of the other animals and the history of the universe and why humans are so dumb, you know, that kind of thing, as well as having full-length cat ventures in it to give the people something to run. And then the third book is called Worlds of Cthulhu, and I got several other RPG authors to contribute their own settings. And the settings generally have some sort of cat venture in them, but they're all over the place. They're like a Star Wars-like setting, which is like cats versus androids in outer space. There's a Great Gatsby setting. There's a steampunk setting. There's one which is Viking lands, where mechs are fighting giants, and the cats are crucial to the survival of the Vikings in some way. All right, so that's 9 different settings beyond the ones that are suggested in the other books. So those 3 books together, plus the cat dice, plus the character sheets, and some other goodies I threw in, really made what has been selling steadily for years. And now that it's 2024, it's the 10th anniversary of that coming out, and we just did the Kickstarter for the 10th anniversary edition. And that's got years more of feedback into it, refining the challenges and the rules, which, even though I try to keep them to a minimum, as you can imagine, there's a lot of situations that could come up for a group of cats. I try to at least address some of them. So that just finished.
How did you decide who you're going to work with when you did decide to add those like extras, like cats in space versus the robots or whatever? Did you have like favorite RPG friends or designer? It's just interesting to hear that.
I did, but I was just getting started making my own game at the time, and I was a member of the IGDN, the Indie Game Designers Network, and so I had this built-in community. It's great for anyone just starting out with RPGs. I just built in community of people I'd go to and said, hey, you want to write for Cthulhu? And they did. So it's still around, the IGDN. I'm not a beginner anymore, so their programs aren't really pointed at me, but it's a great thing to look into for people just getting started.
That's awesome. And so then, as far as the game goes, is there anyone who has compared it to like something else, especially since the system, you don't really do the math? Have people enjoyed that, or have like heavy RPGers been like, oh, not really for me? Like, how has it been received?
I mean, I have to say, I've been very lucky with the way it's been received. In my experience, even hardcore gamers, if they play a session of it, they just think it's tremendous fun. And those are often the people who are only going to want to play it every now and then as a one-shot evening between their big, you know, 400-page rulebook games. But they've all enjoyed it. And in fact, it's been popular enough that it's been translated into, I think, 5 languages, including a Chinese edition that I can't read at all, but that is just beautiful. And we're going to do that again with the 10th anniversary book. Because those were all, the 3 books from the previous edition are all half-size softback. But we're going to combine all of those and update them into a full-color hardback, full-size book.
What made you decide on the first edition, like, hey, this game, I think it's perfect, or I think it's what it needs to be at the time. I want to self-publish it.
Well, I had been self-publishing D&D style adventures with my brother, like I said, with Faster Monkey. So I kind of knew what was required to typeset a book and get it edited and get it printed. It just never occurred to me that anyone else would be interested in publishing this because it was so silly and simple. I had no idea it was going to become as popular as it did. So, I've never thought about why didn't I have someone else publish it. It's only as I've gotten into board game design that I found I really prefer to work with a publisher. I probably should have, in retrospect. I did run into some issues because by creating a boxed set, which I did, with dice in it and other goodies, pens and so on, I unknowingly crossed from the world of book publishing into the world of manufacturing. And some of the partners that I had picked on my own, not really knowing what I was doing, created a lot of difficulties for me in getting the physical box sets produced and shipped to people around the world. And I had no idea. I had crossed without realizing it into a different world. Book publishing, I knew. That was easy, relatively easy. But I didn't know what it took to get a box with dice and multiple books in it, printed, assembled, and shipped. I know a lot more about that now. But I also find it's nice to work with a publisher that has existing partnerships and they know people around the world who do the necessary things. And generally, they know more about fulfillment and stuff like that.
Now, fulfillment is like one of my least favorite parts of the whole process since I have it's to like terrible. Do crap like that. It's not fun. And it's something no. that you really don't have full control over. And I am a bit of a control freak.
Yeah. It's like, why can't I just hand the game to all the people who want it? Why does it have to go through all of this?
Ooh, I definitely do not want to be the post office person, but fair. What was your favorite and your least favorite part of like this whole experience, but more so geared towards designing, less so what we were just mentioning?
Logistics. The fulfillment was my least favorite, but talking about game design, I have been concerned sometimes that I made it look too silly because it is full of H.P. Lovecraft puns and my own possibly twisted idea of humor. And it has cats or cat-like creatures on all the book covers. And possibly as a result of that, I got a lot of reactions early on from people who said, well, you just combined cats and Cthulhu. Of course people are going to buy it. Anybody could put a cat on the cover and sell a game. And they were inevitably people who hadn't actually opened the book and read it. Because I got a lot more feedback from people who at least flipped through it or started reading it or maybe read it all the way through and said, wow, this is really good. And they said, hey, Joel, you're actually a great writer. This is really clever. I love the way this game fits together.
Oh, that's so sad, actually.
Yeah, because literally there were people, some of whom were also aspiring RPG designers, some of whom, I don't know, were just like, oh, anybody could put a cat on a cover and sell a book, as if they were doing something that was in a different artistic level. Yeah, that hurt. That hurt a little bit.
No, I know. I've been through that. It's so dumb and obnoxious.
Yeah. But fortunately, a lot more people actually liked the way I designed it. So that was good. That was lucky for me, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, if you're going on 10 years and have done multiple printings, that's awesome.
In terms of mechanics, every time I read through the game again, I want to simplify it more. And there are a few things in the early edition that are not in the 10th anniversary edition that I've just stripped away, such as, I've never gotten a 9 lives mechanic that I like, and I've tried a few different ones, right? And you would think it would make sense. You know, if a cat gets in real trouble, the player can say, oh, I sacrificed one of my 9 lives to get out of it. But I've never been able to get it to work, because half the time, or more than half the time, it's being played as a one-shot. So it's not like these players are saving 8 of their 9 lives for another day. And the other way I've tried it is you can achieve something by risking your life and might cross one of your lives off, but it was kind of the same thing. It's like you'd have to play the same cat for months to burn through 9 lives, no matter how I use it mechanically. So I finally just got rid of it. You know, it's still in the chatter. The cat herder can still say, oh, that was a lucky roll. You definitely use one of your 9 lives up there. But mechanically, I could never make it fit, so I just cut it out.
No, that makes sense. I feel like sometimes it's kind of cool to keep those thematic elements, but if it's not necessary or just doesn't add anything to the game, why keep it?
Yeah, I tried. It just didn't, there was no need for it mechanically, and I was trying to jam it in there with a shoehorn, so we're better off without it.
Was there any other, like, massive changes that you're like, oh, I really wanted this to work, but it didn't really work?
Well, there used to be three levels of challenges instead of just easy and hard that we have now. And there used to be a Blaze of Glory rule where if you were willing to have your cat definitely die doing something, it automatically succeeded. And that's a little dark. I don't know if that needs to be in there. But the one thing I did keep was the dire challenges. These are very rare, but it's a situation where your cat could get hurt or even killed if they try this challenge. The player always has a choice. The cat herder should never force a player into sacrificing their cat that way. But it can't. You can choose to do it. And then you roll three dice looking for two successes, but every failure that comes up is an injury to your cat. And if you get three, the cat passes on. So it's to be used with caution.
Baby.
I know. And in fact, in most adventures, it will never come up. But if you are, like in some of the ones where it proceeds from one adventure to the next and you eventually end up facing down like an evil cult or something, it's an option. You could have it in there. But it should never be the only way for the cast to succeed. So it doesn't come up very often. I'm not really interested in tracking hit points or anything like that. There's no hit points in the game. No armor class. It's just a roll off. There's one other wrinkle to the cat dice that I am keeping. In fact, it used to be an optional rule. And in 10th anniversary, this is now the official rule. It's called Snake Eyes and Midnight. One of the reasons you roll, even if you are the right cat for an easy challenge and you're automatically going to succeed, you roll the two cat dice anyway. Because if double ones comes up, that's snake eyes. And that means that your cat is embarrassed by the result. And it's up to the player to describe what this embarrassment is. And if you're the right cat for the job and it's an easy challenge, you still succeed, but you succeed in an embarrassing way. So you describe how you knocked something over accidentally, but it turned out to hit the button you were trying to hit anyway, something like that. Whereas if you get double sixes, that's midnight, because it's 12, and that is a triumph. And the player gets to describe how their cat triumphantly meets the challenge, like with extra panache and flair. And the cat herder might give them a little bit of extra success or information for that. And they come up just often enough to keep it interesting. Sometimes it's a simple thing, like the cats are rolling to see if they notice a sound and one of them gets snake eyes. And then that player says, well, turned out I was too busy grooming myself. I paid no attention. I have no idea what's going on. So it doesn't have to be the end of the world. We're not doing critical hits and critical failures. We're not tracking, you know, hit points and injuries and things like that. It's just like an embarrassing result or a triumphant result. So that's official now. And the new cat dice, that's why the new cat dice have different faces on the one and the six. So when you roll it, you can see if it's one of these extra fierce success faces that came up or one of these extra sad failure faces. Again, even though you're rolling two six-sided dice, you're not even adding up the two dice. It's just how many came up happy and how many came up sad. And if a quote-unquote bad guy, a non-cat of some kind, is opposing the cats, they roll the cat dice too, but they succeed on the sad cats because that means something bad for the cats happened. So the odds are stacked against the non-cats that you oppose.
No, that definitely makes sense. I personally, when I like to play RPGs, because I don't play a ton of them, mostly because I just don't have the time to get the same group of people. It's similar to why I try to avoid starting legacy games, since I have never finished one.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, I like it when it is very story-based and less so about, oh, I rolled poorly or I rolled really well. I personally prefer to just improv and make up a story, and I think that's really cute. Like, oh no.
Yes, perfect. Yeah, this would be the perfect game for you. That frustration you're getting at there is what drove me away from D20 systems in the end.
As in you don't do it at all or just in this game?
Oh no, occasionally, but it's what made me want to make a game that was not another D20 system or similar, because I don't know, it just, to me, it doesn't make a good story if your character dies because you rolled low on a d20 when you were saving versus poison. I mean,
yeah, I agree with that.
And I played games like that for many years, so don't get me wrong, I don't think that they should be illegal or anything. I just wanted to play something where the player has more control, more influence over what happens.
For sure. So I always ask to give a piece of advice to designers, but I'm going to ask specifically, how do you design a game outside of a pre-made system for an RPG? Like, what would be your advice for that?
My real advice would be don't, because there are a lot.
That's so funny.
There are a lot of games these days that didn't used to exist that give you a very, very flexible framework and a lot of control to the players and can be adapted to any setting. You can go Powered by the Apocalypse system, which is terrific for having very different characters with very different abilities, and every ability is balanced with its risks and rewards. You can use something like Fate, which is super generic, I believe complete open license. A lot of die rolling in it, but it's very, very bell curved. It's four dice. So it goes from -4 to +4, but it's very bell curved to come in the middle so that your character's abilities are what make the difference more than the die rolls. There are Fate books out there with any number of different ways to describe characters and give them their own different powers. And there are probably others that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. If you have an idea for a complicated game setting and a complicated game, especially if you are emulating a genre or a piece of fiction, there's a lot to be said for using a generic system like that. On the other hand, if you're making an incredibly simple game, like I'm working on one now based on the Popeye the Sailor comic strips from the early 20th century.
Oh, yeah. I still have a costume for that for Halloween, so I know.
Do you?
Get some spinach. Yep. Mm-hmm. I used to watch the cartoon.
That's great. I am making my own system for that, but again, because it's very simple. The other one is Zombie World from Magpie, where it's card-based. I'm going to use some card-based mechanics for Poop Deck, which is what I'm calling the Popeye the Sailor adventures.
Oh, jeez.
His father was Poop Deck Pappy. A lot of people don't realize that.
I remember Pappy. I did not remember that first part. Okay. Well, it's so funny. So what other things are you working on that people should be looking out for?
Oh, well, I don't always keep it up to date, but quite a few of my projects are at MrJoel.com. That's MisterJoel. I did have Harvest Hoppers come out with Snowbright Studio earlier this year, which is a cute on the surface, but secretly very cutthroat game of frogs riding bicycles to deliver vegetables during a food festival in a little, you know, animal people town. That's one I've been working on for a long time and changed themes many times, but I'm very happy with how that came out. And that goes up to 6 players. What else? Oh, I am making a series of board games based on the works of the science fiction writer Jack Vance. Very kindly, his son and publisher gave me the license to develop that. So there's going to be a few of those coming out, I hope.
Are you self-publishing them?
I may work with Erasmus Fox again, which is the people who helped me do the Kickstarter for the 10th anniversary Cthulhu. They were a big help in making that into a success. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, a lot of the Jack Vance game development was put on hold to work on the 10th anniversary. So I will know more about that as time goes on.
Very awesome. Well, hopefully that all goes well. I know it can be difficult to juggle multiple projects, but it sounds like you got it going. For my last question, that's completely unrelated to everything we've already talked about. If you could have designed a game that you didn't design, what would it be?
No Thanks. Have you heard of this?
Interesting. Push Your Luck, yeah.
It is the greatest game I have ever seen in terms of the drama and humor it creates per rule. Because there are, I think, about 2 rules, maybe 3, and it is always fun. And I would love to be able to create something that simple and effective.
Yeah, I think I played the German version a few years, like 2 years ago in Essen with Kathleen Mercury, and it was quite funny. But also, I should not have started any game at 2 a.m. But I do remember it being pretty, like, slap happy fun.
If you're going to start a game at 2 a.m., that's a good choice.
It's not the worst one, because she's like, let's play something. I was like, oh my God, I want to go to bed. And she's like, yeah, you'll be fine. It's really simple. And I was like, all right. As she pulls out a German thing, and I was like, oh, it's only numbers. We're good.
Yeah, Kathleen's great. And even though there are numbers, there's no math in that one either.
Yep. Just need to know if the numbers are next to each other. So if you can count, you can play that game.
Yeah, which I usually can. Maybe not at 2 in the morning.
Problems for another day.
I will say that I tried for years to develop really complicated like Euro game style board games. And inevitably, to make them good after lots of playtesting involved just cutting more and more out and making them as simple as possible.
I also have a tendency to do that.
Yeah, for sure, right? Development is mostly excision.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm very good about streamlining games, but I do like trying to make Euros. I just typically have co-designers for it because they are the ones adding while I'm the one trimming. We balance.
Oh, that works out. That's great.
Well, thanks again, Joel, and thank you for everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 90. Cthulhu. I know, right? 90 episodes. I'm getting there. Almost 100.
That's amazing. Well, this was terrific. I really appreciate you having me.
Yeah, and I mean, you already mentioned your website. Did you have any other like social media things you wanted people to follow?
I believe that you can still see, I think if you go to the 10th anniversary Cthulhu on Kickstarter, and this is another dumb thing I did, which is invent a game name that no one can spell, which makes it hard for people to Google you. But Cthulhu. If you find Cthulhu on Kickstarter, I think you can still sign up for the updates and so on. We're going to have a pledge manager coming out. So anybody who missed it can either get in touch with me directly through Facebook or MrJoel.com or go to the Kickstarter. And, you know, we're zipping along with it.
Well, awesome. And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're looking to find me on my website, it's dmrcreativegroup.com. Or just go on my Instagram, Twitter, or Blue Sky under Token Gamer, and that's, you know, G-A-Y-M-E-R. But yeah, thanks, Joel, for being on the show. It was fun knocking into you in person at Gamma and then continuing to talk.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.